Ladies and gentlemen, whilst there's a number of people still to come, time is running on a little bit, so I guess we better get underway. I'm Greg Lindsay, Executive Director of the CIS from Sydney, and I'd like to welcome you tonight to this, the 10th in a rather lengthy series of lectures and public policy forums we've been running all over Australia, known as the Bert Kelly Lectures. This series is a national one, as I said, and named in honour of Bert Kelly, the long-term member for the federal seat of Wakefield in South Australia, a Minister for the Navy and Minister for Works at one time, but perhaps best known as the modest member and the modest farmer from his columns in the Financial Review and other outlets. Throughout the year, the various lectures and forums will have been to every state capital, and we even decided to give Canberra a go. And the last ones, we tend to, even though we're closer than just about anybody else in the capital to Canberra, we tend to try and ignore it. Except we've decided to run the last of the forums this year, last of the seminars in Canberra. The next one is in Hobart, last month in Brisbane, prior to that in Melbourne and so on. And all these seminars have covered a wide range of topics, from the provision of infrastructure to what we mean by federalism to this particularly important one tonight. Some of you will be aware that the series has been sponsored by the law firm Baker & McKenzie, and that we're particularly grateful. We couldn't possibly have run this series of seminars all over Australia without their help, particularly because of the travel costs, and that's essentially where the funds have gone, for bringing people like David Thompson over from New Zealand, and even me over from Sydney. And the important thing with the Baker & McKenzie partners is that they're prepared to put their name behind the development and articulation of important ideas. And I think it's important that people in the business community think of this particular approach to ideas, because if they can put their names behind the debates that affect the way in which they work, that's bound to enlighten us all. I don't want to talk very much longer, so it's my pleasant duty to welcome the three speakers tonight and to introduce briefly, because I won't, again, most of you have seen the brochure, the first of the speakers, Alan Tapper. Alan studied at the University of Western Australia. His main interests are philosophy and 18th century British intellectual history, and currently he's teaching philosophy at Edith Cowan University. He's probably best known for his book in 1990, The Family and the Welfare State. So I invite Alan to address us. Thank you, Alan.
Thanks very much, Greg. Most Australians believe that the Australian welfare state is working moderately well. Not all of us believe that, but most of us do. 10 years ago, I held that view. To me then, unemployment levels seemed high. Separation and divorce was a major fact of life amongst people I knew, and youth problems seemed to be emerging, but the welfare system seemed to me unconnected to these matters, and it seemed to me to be operating reasonably well. That was my view before I began any research in the area. Recently, in response to a friend who expressed a similarly optimistic or complacent view of our welfare system, I found myself describing the system as a kind of bedlam. On calmer reflection, I guess that is too strong a term for my present view, but not very much too strong. Here I'll defend a less emotive description. The dominant characteristic in the operation of welfare policy is, I believe, one of confusion. Welfare policy is a complex field because it involves highly contestable ethical and economic assumptions. In such a complex area, it is easy to score superficial victories. By taking a strong stand on any one more or less plausible ethical or economic principle, while playing down the merits of any competing principles, one can easily seem, to oneself at least, a paragon of high-mindedness and political rectitude. This is a temptation for all of us right across the political spectrum. I shall try to resist that temptation. I intend to argue for a position that, I believe, must seem plausible to the large majority of Australians, not just any small in-group. For this reason, I will start by sketching the findings of an about-to-be-published study of the Australian welfare state, Living Decently, by Peter Travers and Sue Richardson. Living Decently is the most authoritative analysis of Australian living standards yet written. It's also the best defence we have of the Australian welfare state. The analysis is based on their Australian Standards of Living study, a survey of what they term full income, which calculated current money incomes, income taxes, and the value of assets and leisure. No such complete calculations have been performed previously in Australia. The survey went further still into health, happiness, and social participation. Travers and Richardson found that inequalities in current money incomes are largely offset by assets and leisure. Full incomes in the top quintile, that's the top 20%, are only 2.6 times those in the bottom quintile, and some of that disparity is explained by age differences. After age 35, they say, chances of being in poverty decline continuously with age, and to the point that they are negligible around age 65. Even more remarkably, quoting again, being unemployed or out of the labour force is not significantly associated with lower incomes in any of its varieties for either men or women. End of that quote. Those who are least well off by their full income criterion are a mixed lot, mainly pensioners, non-age pensioners, unskilled workers, and families with children, including sole parent families. No surprises there. On a broader front, the study found that self-reported happiness rises with living standards, but only slightly. Those who are least well off materially are far from miserable, and they participate in social activities almost as fully as those above them in income terms. When age differences are accounted for, there is only a slight positive correlation between full income and self-assessed health. Taking all this together, the authors seem almost justified in claiming that, as they put it, we have observed many strong features in the Australian version of capitalism as modified by the welfare state. Australian society is marked by considerable material equality and by relatively high levels of social mobility. Isn't this what we wanted the welfare state to achieve? Having outlined Travers and Richardson's results, let me now offer you 8 findings of my own in roughly the order in which they became evident. First, today, for every dollar of assistance to a child in a two-parent family, there is about $10 assistance to each child in a sole-parent family. This point was first made in 1990 in my book, The Family and the Welfare State. The evidence for it was readily available throughout the 1980s, but was never brought forward. Second, according to data in the 1987 ABS fiscal incident study, two-parent families are now net contributors to the social budget, not net recipients. In other words, the welfare state is no longer about general support for families with children. Third, the welfare state of today supports the elderly. Each year there is a net annual transfer to people over 60 of about $15 billion, or about $6,000 per elderly person, though of course the elderly are already well endowed with assets and they do not have children to care for. This transfer means that they are now mostly better off materially than the young, as Travers and Richardson also found. Fourth, as David Thompson has shown, the welfare state has involved not just life cycle imbalances, but much more strikingly, generational imbalances. Net lifetime transfers to the generation which is now enjoying retirement have been massive. This generation benefited in the 1950s and 60s when the state favoured the young, and benefited again when the state later transferred its favours to the elderly. To give just one illustration of this, the lifetime personal income taxes paid by an average couple from that generation will amount to only a fraction, probably less than half, of the value of the age pension they will receive. Contrary to common assumptions, this generational trend has not been brought under control. In the past 3 years, for instance, age pension payments have grown dramatically, by 20% in real terms. Expenditure on health assistance to the elderly continues to rise steadily. Fifth, on average, couples who split up and take the sole parent pension will receive, over a 3 to 4 year period, which is the average stay on that pension, at least $60,000 in pensions, tax relief, and various forms of government services, which they would not have received if they had stayed together. The true figure is likely to be higher than this, since many take the pension more than once, and $80,000 is not at all enforceable. However, large though this figure is, it is small by comparison with the gains to today's older generation. Sixth, it is mistaken to think of sole parent families as particularly disadvantaged. After the welfare state has played its part, their real incomes are very little less than those of average two-parent family incomes. On an equivalent final incomes basis, low-income sole parent families are much better off than low-income two-parent families. The image of sole parent poverty seems to be not an honest mistake, for my figures have been readily available since 1987. Rather, it's an image cultivated by welfare advocates with a vested interest in its promotion. Seventh, It is not implausible to suppose that two-parent families pay fairly heavily for transfers to sole-parent families. It is hard to see who else is paying for this. The 55 to 65 age group are not net contributors. And the taxes of people who have not yet had children are fully taken up in paying for the elderly. On this way of looking at the situation, it seems possible that a bill of $3 billion is shared between about 2 million two-parent families at a cost of about $1,500 per family per year or $30 per week. Eighth, it is impossible to be exact about how young families of today will lose by the process of transfers to today's older generation. But one indicator of it is this. Those today who are between the ages of 25 and 44 will pay about seven times as much in effective income taxes as was paid at that stage of life by today's older generation. The overall effect of these facts has been the radical devaluation of the two-parent family in particular and of the fortunes of young people in general. To answer immediately one criticism which will arise here, the devaluation is of all two-parent family types, whether biological intact families or step families or blended families. It has also devalued sole parent families in which the custodial parent is self-supporting. Yet, the family is a welfare institution. It cares for people in need of support, most of whom are children. The welfare state has devalued the central welfare institution in any society, the family. For that reason alone, there is no good case for thinking of the welfare state as an advance on what preceded it. At best, it can only be no worse than earlier social arrangements, for it has only shifted support from the two-parent family to other, no more deserving groups. However, the accumulated evidence seems to me to go further than this. It tells us that the performance of the Australian welfare state has been virtually arbitrary. The post-war welfare state began as a system of reciprocity between equals in the form of a contract between generations. This contract was never monitored. In fact, the trend away from the young and towards the elderly dates back to the early 1950s, though of course it accelerated dramatically in the late 1960s and through the 1970s. The absence of monitoring has been total. There has been simply no literature on the subject of generational gains and losses in the Australian welfare state, and there has been no policy designed to prevent intergenerational imbalances. The outcome is that the contract between generations can now only be described as a miserable failure, indeed a fraud, though an unintentional fraud. In short, the first generation scooped the pool. While this was taking place in the 1970s, the welfare state set itself a quite different goal that of achieving greater social equality. That attempt also went awry. As with the generational imbalance, large bonuses were delivered to select groups, most notably to couples who split up, for no obvious reason. Whether overall material equality decreased or increased as a result of this, we simply do not know. For this matter too was never properly monitored. We have no studies from the 1970s or earlier, even remotely comparable to the work of Travers and Richardson. To make matters worse, we have lost all sense of the goal of the relationship between the goal of equalisation between rich and poor, known as vertical equity, and the goal of maintaining reciprocity between equals, usually referred to as horizontal equity. Consequently, questions about the bonuses to the elderly can be brushed off with remarks about poverty. Similarly, bonuses to couples who split up, which are really an example of horizontal inequity, have always been treated as though they were a requirement of vertical equity, though they are not properly means-tested, and there is no obvious reason why couples who split up are much less able to support their children than are other couples. Then too, absurdly, the parties who have profited so heavily from the welfare state have been encouraged to think of themselves as victims, even when they have been able to take out vastly more than they have put in. Today, victimism is all around us. It's the standard formula for obtaining public support, and it is a highly successful formula by and large. Not to play that game is to put one's interests at risk. It is for reasons of this sort that I would describe the welfare state as a state of bedlam. They are by no means the only reasons for that view. Much more could be said about the rise of welfare dependency and the evidence of welfare-related social dysfunction. More generally, the welfare state has both fostered and needed pervasive changes in ethical outlook. Once, being self-supporting, not being a burden on others, was a source of pride. Today, nearly one in three adults have government payments as their principal source of income. Our task in the 1990s is to find ways out of the maze of confusion, moral and material, which we have constructed. The effects of this confusion go deep. In the welfare maze, we have become like a collection of unrelated individuals, blindfolded and bumping into each other at every turn. Removing the blindfolds is the first requirement of a better society. But the difficulty of doing this illustrates the general difficulty we face. Those who have the resources and training to conduct objective social analysis, that is, the welfare professional class, are almost all idealists committed to the defence of their ideals, whatever the evidence might appear to show about welfare failure. Idealists of this sort assume that critics are attacking the ideals of the welfare state, and they reply in terms of those ideals. I can see little point in discussing the ideals, for the social reality bears no relation to the advertising. about this reality, there is a large information barrier between the professionals and the public. Honest confrontation of the sort of claims I've been making, by way of refutation, if that is possible, is practically non-existent. A good society will need to be a less idealistic society, for the idealism of the welfare state has been its downfall. It will also be a society which gives some recognition to the family, not just, as at present, one family form, but all its now varied forms. The welfare state has turned out to be a hostile environment for the young, especially for young families. It has damaged their work prospects, it has burdened them with debts, and it has facilitated, indeed heavily subsidised, their breakup. Recognition of all this could form the basis of a political programme. It has what all such programmes require, a positive vision, that of protecting the interests of the young. It may also have some popular support. Certainly, it could appeal to values which are widely shared. And it would wrong-foot the entrenched interest groups who have profited from the present maldistribution. Opponents would be unable to argue on grounds of justice, for the facts speak so clearly against any such claim. In practical terms, the target would need to be to halve current expenditure on the elderly and on family breakdown in order to transfer the savings, about $9 billion annually, to young families. Unfortunately, however, it would be unlikely to succeed, even if we worked at it steadily for a decade. Someone will have to suffer. If we were to succeed in giving the young a fair go, then those of us who are now in the middle of our working lives will have to pay out in two directions, to our parents and to our children. That would make an interesting epitaph for the so-called me generation to have carved on its historical gravestone. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alan. Our next speaker is Tony Rutherford. Tony trained as a historian at the University of Western Australia and Edinburgh University, where, as I understand it, he spent a fair part of his time wandering around the northern parts of Scotland looking at peculiar rocks. However, now he's coming down to the ground, so to speak, and as a public policy analyst, has been a public policy analyst in varying ways since 1976, and is currently at the Institute of Public Affairs. His most recent publications include Mabo and After, and the jointly edited IPA publication Reform and Recovery. I'll ask Tony now to address us on welfare states and moral hazards. Thank you, Tony.
Yes, thank you, Greg. I'd just like to say, before I really start, that I'm pleased to be able to honour Bert Kelly in this way. I was one of those people for whom Bert was an important influence. I first remember him for his very elegant refutation of the theory of bureaucratic omniscience. If those buggers are so clever, why aren't they sitting in the south of France with their feet in a bucket of champagne? I later discovered he had a sense of humour as well. Moral hazard in the welfare state. I just thought I'd start the thinking process, if you like, with some very specific examples and then work in from there. Perhaps the surest sign that Australia's welfare state was in a pretty bad way was the proposal that started off at the tax summit in 1985 and was strangled shortly after the 1987 election for a national identity card, which the government charmingly called the Australia card. The main purpose of the card, apart from its tax function, was to cope with a huge amount of social security fraud. The government in those days put that conservatively at about $1 billion worth of fraud a year. It's worth noting that that same government, the Labor government, had already tightened up quite considerably on the wealth test for pensioners, although in the long run that didn't make much difference. And it was to struggle then and now, hopelessly, to prevent Medicare fraud and over-servicing as that fraud. The card, the Australia card, the ID card, as we all call it, was also, I think we should remember, merely on top of what you might think of as the fraud squad activities, the old Department of Social Security. Those sorts of themes have become commonplace over the last 2 years. The attempt to eliminate fraud and the attempt to narrow eligibility. Don't know whether the first one has been very successful, the second one certainly hasn't. If we think about the Australia card episode, what stands out is the scale of the fraud. Think of it this way, $1 billion is something like 100,000 citizens, each defrauding the state each year of about $10,000. Now, if that occurred in any other field of dishonest endeavour, we would think of that as being something like a crime epidemic. Apparently we don't. What stands out about the changes to the wealth test for the pension is that the changes were due mainly to the number of perfectly respectable aged citizens who were quite deliberately rearranging their affairs so as to qualify for something which at the very least was a handy income supplement. The other example I want to start off with is quite a recent one. It's only from June this year, the Fitzgerald Report, the report on national savings. Dr. Fitzgerald's brief was to look at trends in saving, at the importance of saving to the economy, where we were going wrong, and to suggest some appropriate policy measures. Fitzgerald was very much concerned with public saving, and that's what his recommendations are basically concerned with. I mean, we have a federal government which is dis-saving this year to the extent of at least $20 billion. But he did draw attention to the problem of the decline in personal saving, particularly in conjunction with the other problem we face, which is the ageing of the welfare state. As far as personal saving goes, Dr. Fitzgerald is really quite reticent. He doesn't actually say a great deal about it, and he basically repeats a few economic orthodoxies, which is not surprising because it's a very orthodox report and it doesn't deal very much with moral issues, particularly the moral issues associated with deficit financing. And in fact, the interesting thing about all of these examples is how incomplete the public analysis in each case has been. We know a lot about the cost of fraud to the state. We know a lot about the ageing of the welfare state. We know a lot about changing dependency ratios. The ABS will tell you about that right down to the year 2051. We know a lot about savings and investment now. We know a lot about all sorts of things. But there's been almost no serious discussion in any of these instances about the foundations of the welfare state and the ethos of the welfare state, particularly in the moral sense. By that, I don't mean the welfare state as a moral or ethical project in itself. We have to accept, I think, that the origins of the welfare state and much of its subsequent extension were rooted in some fairly, honourable ethical intentions. And indeed, that's part of the problem. I think Alan's made that clear. The obvious good intent of so much of state-based welfare activity has served to make criticism difficult. And even now, with evidences of failure all about us, the prevailing assumption still is that the project itself is morally unassailable, however much it may be in need of administrative tidying up. But what I really think is all too rarely discussed are the assumptions we've made and we continue to make about the moral behaviour of the citizens of the welfare state and about their personal moral behaviour, rather than any sort of generic or civic virtues that they may have. Virtue is, of course, a monumentally unfashionable subject. Those people who determine the tone of public discourse in Australia are very uncomfortable with concepts like that. We're permitted to admire some individual virtues, such as courage in sporting heroes, or the selfless dedication of people like Fred Hollows. But other moral considerations are explicitly excluded, as, to take Fred Hollows' example again, the disapproval that Hollows brought on himself in talking about AIDS. And we tend to be very reticent in discussing moral issues in relation to public policy. On all sides of public policy, politics in general, there's a pious orthodoxy, if you like, that government action has to be morally neutral. We then tend to take the intent for the reality. And if we assume that if government, you know, says that it's observing the rules, it is observing the rules. And there's another real difficulty, which is in a way the worst one. We have no statistical grip on virtue. Almost anything we say about virtue is based on very shaky statistical foundations. Foundations in economists will call anecdotal evidence, which is, as evidence goes, less than no evidence at all. That means we have to talk in something like moral aggregates, and we have to acknowledge that for everything we say about general patterns of moral behaviour, there will be exceptions. In this case, the exceptions don't disprove the rule. So the virtues I want to talk about tonight are not heroic ones, the sort of exceptional courage or the extraordinary endurance or the unusual sanctity. I want to talk about the lesser virtues, the achievable virtues. Naming virtues is a very imprecise business, but I think I'll be understood here if I refer to a number in particular: thrift, self-reliance, a sense of duty to family and community, fair sharing, self-restraint, and a sense of obligation to those well off than oneself. These are all among what I would call the spectacularly unfashionable virtues. But oddly enough, I suspect that if you asked Morgan Poll to conduct a survey on whether people thought there should be more of them, you'd get a resounding yes. They're among the sort of virtues, the moral qualities, that we think of as being Victorian, that were indeed assiduously promoted in the second half of the 19th century, but were perhaps more characteristic of English-speaking societies from somewhere around about the 1910s, very roughly, to the late 50s or early 60s. And they're by no means sufficient in themselves for a good society, but they're not a bad start, and they are necessary. I single them out tonight for a number of reasons, because together they represent, if you like, the moral environment in which the welfare state was born. They explain much of the initial success of the welfare state. They've been very considerably eroded by the welfare state. That erosion explains much of the present difficulties of the welfare state. And to come back to the beginning, they offer a useful starting point in trying to think about its successor state. That's a fairly strong series of claims, but I think to understand them, we only have to understand really perhaps two basic points. The first point is that the welfare state was only ever going to succeed to the extent that it had limited aims and limited coverage. The universal welfare state, is an economic illusion. The way income is actually distributed in society makes any more than quite modest redistribution very difficult. In the end, there's just not enough to go around. Soaking the rich doesn't work. that's one reason why a characteristic feature of our sort of welfare society is middle class tax welfare churning. But the welfare state, as many, including David Thompson, would define it, includes not only the first round income redistribution, but also the provision of housing and health services, education, and the extensive protection of both labour and product markets. And that comes at too high an economic cost to be sustainable for very long. And in this sense, Australia has had a welfare state almost since Federation, at least since the Harvester case. But despite the First World War and the Depression, it was, apart from the product and labour market protection, a relatively modest affair until the 50s, when we encountered the post-war economic boom. It grew rapidly for about 30 years. It grew for a number of reasons. An ideological commitment to redistribution, a non-ideological desire, I think, sort of ethical good intentions I was talking about earlier, just to improve the quality of life for those less well off, and we were a wealthy nation, and a varying, up and down, depending on how cynical you are, desire on the part of politicians to buy votes. And it was in this latter period, the flourishing of the welfare state, that moral habits began to change, and to change faster than any of us, I think, would thought possible. My second point is that the virtues, the moral habits that I've been talking about, are not, for the most part, innate. We're not born with them. They're very much acquired things. We acquire them by instruction, by example, both of those in particular in the family context, by sanction, by reflection, and by exercise. They're sometimes only very weakly rooted in rationality, not least because we very often don't know how far other people will take advantage of our virtue. Moral free riding is a serious question, a problem in society. For most of us, ordinary mortals, there are always exceptions. Virtue will not actually persist very strongly when it appears to be perverse. So when ordinary mortals encounter an environment of public policy which makes their virtues seem perverse, or indeed counterproductive, they'll change. So I go back to the examples I started off with. As far as I could ever see, at a time when I was very familiar with Australia's social security system, and I was in politics myself, the people whose actions actually made up that $1 billion worth of fraud that generated the Australia card were fairly ordinary people. I don't think a lot of them had actually been in and out of Fremantle Jail. But whatever sense of fair sharing, of restraint, of self-reliance they had ever had been weakened to the point where fraud was something like a rational response. The second example, perhaps more shocking for those of us who are conservatively raised to think of our parents' generation, or my parents' generation, as our, not only our elders, but our moral betters, was the systematic way a great number of people systematically rearranged their affairs to qualify for the age pension. People of my parents' generation, as I say, the ones who studiously spent their $300,000 lump sum in order to qualify for the age pension. And we go on to the grey areas, like Medibank, you know, the wealthy individuals who boasted that as soon as Medicare was introduced, they dropped out of private health insurance. The ones who shift their houses so that children can attend a good government high school. And we can see the same coin, the other side of it, in tax evasion. The tax evasion and tax avoidance, which was such a feature of Australian society in the 70s and 80s. When we look at examples like this, and I've deliberately avoided contentious examples like the supporting parent benefit, Alan Tapper is so much braver than I am, we have to recognise the intimate connection between public policy in the shape of the welfare state and private morality. And in some ways, my last example was the most telling one, the example of the Fitzgerald Report into national savings. Because in our terms, the terms that I'm using tonight, what was at issue in the debate over savings was the virtue of thrift. There are, of course, other moral issues arising from things like deficit financing, which are almost overlooked, but that's another couple of hours on another note. Thrift is an interesting virtue. For many people, there was always something really quite irrational about it, at least in terms of thinking of comfortable old age, because the savings of many working class people over the last century or so were often too slender to make possible any real degree of comfort in their old age. But for at least a generation now, all of the incentives have been limited. We've learned the pervasive, complex effects of inflation and taxation. We now know, for instance, as well, that deferring consumption is perverse. If there's a comfortable pension awaiting us when we retire, and if there's no income crisis, ill health, unemployment, threatens during our work. Thrift is very perverse if our superannuation denies us access to the pension. And it's extremely perverse if all of our friends and workmates are consuming as fast as they can. So no wonder we all invest in housing, much to the despair of the economic rationalists around us. But I still wonder what they invest in. So roughly a generation of studiously morally neutral public policy has left us with something of a crisis rooted in the decline of a private virtue, one which we now say we're going to resolve that crisis with a compulsory savings programme. It will be interesting to see how far it goes before people realise that compulsory superannuation has its own moral side effects. I could multiply all these examples at great length, but I'll let them, particularly the last one, stand as sufficient for the argument. And that argument is, in brief, that the welfare state has created a pervasive climate of moral hazard. The very virtues that made the welfare state possible, at least implicitly, have been seriously weakened by it, in some cases destroyed, and in that process, the welfare state effectively destroyed itself. But at this point, I suppose I should dramatically unveil the alternative. But I'm not being paid enough for it. So let me just offer, at the end of that fairly simple analysis, just some modest conclusions, ones which I think follows directly from the points I've raised. The first one, perhaps the most obvious political lesson in thinking about welfare issues, that we learned from these last 30 or so years is that politics is not now a very good way of dealing with either the long term or fiduciary issues, issues that touch on the duty of trust we expect of governments. We will never know, of course, whether the welfare state in any of its forms, Australian or British or New Zealand, was better or worse than whatever alternatives people in very prosperous societies, all of them, might have devised for themselves. But it's now reasonably clear that whatever the successor state to the welfare state looks like, it will have to be considerably less political.
The consequence of that, and this is my second conclusion, seems inevitably to be that over the long term we'll have to trust far more to individuals to make their own welfare arrangements. And in this context, individuals overwhelmingly implies families, although there are all sorts of other private arrangements you could think of. This will involve a very considerable long-term increase in post-tax income. And to drive that point home, I'd just like to remind you of some of my favourite statistics. In 1954-5, the average rate of tax on full-time male average working earners was 9.6%. The top marginal tax rate, cutting at 19 times average weekly earnings. In 1992-3, the fiscal year, the average rate of tax on the same sort of average weekly earnings was about 23%, a lot more than that tax. And the top marginal rate cutting at 1.5 times average weekly earnings. And I should say, if you use straight average weekly earnings rather than full-time male, the figures are a lot worse. That's a rough and, I think, provocative measure of the resources that we as individuals have lost in trying to look after ourselves. And of course they're very rough because I've excluded social wage considerations. My third point, if the welfare state has indeed fatally weakened our moral sense of fair sharing, our sense of not taking more than our due, a sense of refraining from taking until others more deserving had their share, then we will probably have to contemplate quarantining some generations from redistribution. That may be the sort of government interference which I so strenuously argued against 2 minutes ago. The expectation that the young, and indeed those yet to be born, can be expected to pick up the bill indefinitely is hardly conducive to moral behaviour on anyone's part. Similarly, I believe we will have to unquarantine other generations to reinduce in the old a sense of moral propriety in regard to welfare. My last point, we are going to have to stop pretending that whatever their intent, the actions of government do not have moral consequences. To do that, we're going to have to be very much more comfortable in talking about them, or at least about what we believe on the whole to be desirable moral habits. I don't mean that in any prescriptive way, in any way that imputes authority and morals to government. Rather the reverse. To the extent that government steps back from these issues, all of them, I suspect that we would quite rapidly arrive at a situation in which most people, most of the time, would agree implicitly on most of the moral values which will enable our common life to work reasonably well. I may perhaps be misguided. I may only be wildly optimistic. But whatever might follow the welfare state, as we've learned, it will hardly be likely to survive without something like that sort of moral consensus, moral environment. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Tony. I think you're better at coming to grips with those sort of issues than Scottish rocks. Although perhaps the sort of wisdom of Adam Smith was half on during those exercises, percolated through the peat or something like that, via a Glenfiddich perhaps. Anyway, it's my pleasure to introduce our final speaker for tonight, and we'll have a short question period following. And to welcome David and his wife Andrea to Perth from Palmerston North in New Zealand. David is a senior lecturer in history at Massey University in New Zealand, in Palmerston North, and the author of many papers on provision for the ages, the age in the past and present societies. He is the author in 1991 of what I think is one of the most important books I've ever read in a long time, and that's this particular book here, Selfish Generation, The Ageing of New Zealand's Welfare State. And it was reading about that particular book that brought David to our attention, and he's participated in now, this is your second CIS function, and we published a paper of his earlier, sometime last year. David is going to talk on the topic of welfare states and the problem of the common, which I think, if you will find when you listen to him, one might explain some of the problems that we're finding in the modern welfare states. So thank you, David, for joining us, and please pass on some of your words on the problem of the common.
Thank you for the kind introduction, Greg, and for the invitation to join you in the Bert Kelly Lecture Series. It's a pleasure to be here. The previous two speakers have spoken more particularly about Australia. I don't want to do that tonight so much as to talk about and reflect upon the nature of welfare states in general. I think most of my remarks do apply to Australia. But I'll leave the listeners to judge that. So I begin with some general reflections and then develop a number of observations. An array of problems confront all welfare states at century's end, and I think you'll recognise the Australian position amongst those. The mixes of problems vary, but the components are standard. They include mounting unemployment, government expenditure, public debt and welfare dependency, minimal economic growth, widening disparities, falling real incomes and rising child poverty, low investment, poor maintenance and decaying physical assets, environmental degradation, ageing populations and below replacement fertility. And a deterioration in political and moral qualities parallels these, as has been mentioned already. I'm thinking of rising crime and youth suicide, for example, divorce and marriage breakdown, a corrosive cynicism towards all political processes, a loss of civility, of optimism and personal responsibility. The point's already been made, the decline has been particularly severe for the young, that is for those born after about 1960. Welfare states everywhere were established at mid-century quite deliberately to foster children and young adults, through heavy public spending on maternity services, family allowances, child health, free education, housing for families and tax relief. And equally important was the shaping of macroeconomic policy to boost wages, protect full employment or keep interest rates low, for example. Now, that's been abandoned in the last couple of decades as welfare states have been reshaped in the interests of the present middle-aged and elderly and to the lasting detriment of their successors. And at the same time, to generations of winners and losers alike, welfare states have given a deepening sense of insecurity and powerlessness, and a sense of bewilderment, for the dream was that the welfare state would deliver us from these very things. How could this transformation have come about from optimism, growth and investment in the future to disillusionment, stagnation and debt? Well, many explanations are offered, of course, that the vision of collective welfare was flawed, that economic performance hasn't been good enough, that the world's been unkind to us, that political and intellectual leaders have failed to lead, we haven't had enough children or immigrants, that everyone's gone soft and lazy, and so on. But I think there's more to it than this. All modern states seem to go through a similar cycle of advance, stagnation and loss of way, regardless of their economic success, their economic bases, their world trade position, or their political parties. And this common experience suggests that we look further to the very nature of the beast we created at mid-century. And that's my task in this short address tonight, not to argue about particular welfare measures, but to speculate on some of the ways of thinking afresh about the history of the welfare state, and so about possibilities for the future. Mid-century welfare states represented a unique experiment in human history involving the compulsory large-scale pooling and sharing of resources according to ill-defined political rules and controls and according to unclear notions of right and obligation. And that experiment has taken us in directions few foresaw. For the act of pooling in itself sets up new processes, tensions and dynamics, quite independent of whatever goals there might have been behind it all in the first place. Individuals and groups soon learn to, as Tony has mentioned, soon learn to reposition themselves according to the new distribution of benefit and loss. And they also learn to do that repositioning repeatedly, since the very process of repositioning ourselves in turn disturbs whatever new balances might have been emerging. So in short, change has independent momentum and direction of its own. And the way we decided to pool and share resources played a large part in determining that direction and nature. Now, this central issue of the psychologies which underlie exchanges between individuals and groups has been given too little attention. Economists talk, as we had introduced for us this evening, they talk of moral hazard, or the free rider effect and more, as features of the behaviour that a welfare state encourages, and these are important features. But, if I may, Tony, the language of the economists has little popular appeal, and I prefer to look for richer metaphors in exploring the inner dynamics and psychological states of populations caught up in compulsory pooling. Now, one more promising metaphor is that of the giant compulsory chain letter, with its connotations of boom and bust, of childish gullibility, of quick gains for some alongside long-term loss for many others, and of plunder, immorality, and disillusionment. Now, the chain letter analogy was invoked by a number of economists, particularly in North America in the 1950s and 1960s. But its whiff of world-weary cynicism was never fashionable in that era of expansion and confidence, and it was soon forgotten. Well, to this historian, the life cycle of the chain letter looks a fruitful model for anyone writing on the past 50 years of the welfare state. Perhaps more useful still, I think, are some powerful analogies drawn from environmental debates in the 1970s and 80s. In creating welfare states, that is, in creating large-scale pooling of resources and political institutions for managing them, we followed rather unwittingly the age-old model of the common. I use both the terms welfare state and common in particular ways here. The welfare state is a synonym for the modern state. It's not narrowed, as so often nowadays, to just the handout state of cash benefits and free services. I mean the welfare state in the richer mid-century sense, to encompass the many welfare-promoting actions of government, for the pooling of resources extends well beyond simply the taxes we pay or the services we use. Now, similarly, common has a particular meaning, the meaning of a resource shared by a known group according to some communal rather than private property rules. Environmental scholars identify two general types of common and a great many variants of each. Now, one type is what they call open access, or many call open access, under which everyone is free to exploit a shared resource as they like. Air or sea have been the classic examples of open access resource. The other is what's sometimes called the true common, or a communal resource to which a specified group of people hold specific rather than unlimited usage rights. The shared pasture land of the European peasant village is the classic example of the true common, and that's the sense in which I'm using the word common here. Now, the nightmare for all communities when pooling resources is that their sharing will prove badly designed from the outset, or mismanaged, or unmanageable thereafter, and that the pooling will degrade into an exploitive, uncontrollable, free-for-all open access. Well, human communities have several millennia of experience in balancing the various requirements and benefits and disadvantages of private property, of true common, or of open access sharing of resources. And the modern welfare state involves a messy mix of all three, with a heavy tendency towards open access. And many late 20th century concerns are pretty standard outcomes of a failure to learn from the history of good commons management. Because good commons management has a number of interlocking requirements. The first is that the group sharing a pooled resource must be small. Those involved should be few, should be known to each other, and visible to each other, so that good husbandry or abuse of the common will be apparent at once to fellow commoners. But welfare states are, of course, a form of mass common, with pooling across thousands of miles and unseen millions of citizens. The normal restraints and self-policing that arises from interaction within small groups can't apply. And the psychology of open access or the free-for-all is drawn forth inexorably, no matter how responsible most or even all involved might want to be. There were perhaps a number of good reasons why we had mass pooling, why we devised welfare states rather than welfare communities, but that's no way to manage a commons. A second requirement is that the resources to be held and used in common must be clear and specific. Everybody must know what is in and what is not part of the common. The medieval farmer, for instance, enjoyed particular rights to specific attributes of the common land, perhaps could put a set number of cattle to graze on certain parts of the common, or pigs would be allowed to forage for acorns in agreed months. But having commons rights didn't mean that the shared land could be used any old how. That way lay open access and rapid despoilation. Well, welfare states have ignored this imperative. Few boundaries have been firm around what is private property and what's in the pool. And the repeated extension of taxes is perhaps the most obvious example of the pressing out of the boundaries, of the lack of firmness of boundaries. Other examples would be government manipulation of exchange rates or wage levels or of interest payments. Now, the pressure towards this flexible boundary is, of course, understandable. In societies of unequal wealth, while your property remains private and I'm poor, I have no chance to share in it. But I do if I can have part of it or all of it declared some form of commons. Equally, all will at times want the porosity of boundaries to work the other way. Having claimed a benefit from the common, perhaps because I've received a cash payment, I want the freedom to invest it or to pass it on to my children, in other words, to privatise a piece of the common. Porous and movable boundaries have their attraction, but they also destroy commons. Third, sound commons management requires that the users be specified. Commons rights usually lie with the residents of a particular limited locale or the members of certain families or occupations. They'll often exclude some groups within a community. They'll seldom extend to newcomers and never to strangers. That way, once again, lies open access and speedy degradation. And once again, modern welfare states have been careless on this. Entitlement to draw on the pool is often upon loose terms. It's revised frequently and expanded or contracted to no obvious pattern, while newcomers, such as migrants, generally gain full or even privileged common rights from the outset. No one can be sure who will be entitled to what next year or the year after, and no sustainable commons can be run this way. Fourth, in historical communities, commons rights are frequently matched with commons obligations. Obligations, for example, to assist with replanting the woodlot or to repair a hedge, or, very importantly, the obligation to watch over and report upon the actions of others. Smallness and set membership aided in this, but while the welfare states have imposed some commons obligations of a general nature, such as to pay taxes, duties towards maintaining the health of the commons have been little considered. Fifth, transparency is fundamental in good commons management. The operations of a commons must be open to scrutiny and hence to policing. Not only must rights and obligations of individuals be known, users must be visible and encouraged to observe others. This permits and promotes a high degree of self-restraint and of informal disciplining, and it permits a rapid response to such things as intrusion by outsiders. Yet, welfare states are the antithesis of transparent. They're huge, complex, bureaucratic, and beyond the comprehension of most. I wasn't sure whether to say all at that point. Few records of individual behaviours are kept, and certainly no longitudinal ones on what individuals or groups contribute to or draw from the pool over time. And a culture that frowns upon snooping or prying, snitching or dobbing in, I'm not quite sure what the Australian colloquialism would be. Dobbing in? Okay. Perhaps we borrowed that one from you. A culture that frowns upon dobbing in reinforces our ignorance of what's going on. And even the individual has little means of assessing his or her own behaviour relative to the commons, or knowing what is responsible or irresponsible action in relation to the commons. I'll pay around $20,000 in income tax this year and an unknown additional amount of indirect taxes, rates and levies. Yet I can do very little more than guess whether these amounts are large or small relative to what others are contributing, or relative to what I'm receiving back this year, or what I might pay, or what I might receive during a lifetime. There may be excellent humanitarian or libertarian reasons why each of us is kept in such ignorance, but it all runs counter to good commons management. Finally, every sustainable commons has to be backed by a firm willingness to enforce compliance. That is, the commoners have to have and use a range of sanctions, from mild shaming and reproval through fines to ostracism, banishment, or even death. Perhaps not advocating the last. They must also be vigilant, prompt, and consistent in applying the penalties. The welfare states do very little of this, nor perhaps could they, given their size and ill-defined nature. Nor are liberal democracies well-suited to the regulation, investigation, and sanctioning necessary to preserve a healthy commons. Therein lies a central dilemma. In short, then, the commons is a particularly tricky beast to manage sustainably, and the tragedy of the commons, or the slide towards the free-for-all, is an ever-present danger. The welfare state has been an especially ill-designed common, and a predictable pattern of decline has emerged. For an unwieldy common, I suggest, robs individuals of the means to make good, rational decisions for the long-term health of the commons and the group sharing it. Being locked into a blind or mass pooling that we can't see what's going on, being locked into a mass pooling has induced a succession or a train of mental and physical states which are in the long-term interests of very few. Idealism and optimism are eroded and replaced increasingly by cynicism and self-serving. Since citizens find that self-restraint goes unnoticed or brings no reward or is overridden by the demands of the less bashful or cannot ensure the future health of the commons. Public spirit, modest demands or a desire to participate responsibly are eroded by a sense of powerlessness. Joining the plunder and upping one's own demands become the only rational response for the individual, no matter how much the individual might feel that to be wrong. The spiral of suspicion, as we might call it, drives itself on. No one caught up in a compulsory mass commons can feel satisfied or secure or decide that enough is enough, since few of the rules of the game are fixed or enforceable and restraint by others can't be counted upon. And many consequences flow from this psychology of powerlessness and suspicion. In particular, investment and maintenance tumbles, the quality of a shared resource deteriorates, time horizons shorten, and demands for immediate gratification rise, since no one wants to risk being a sucker who holds back or misses out or pays too much. Welfare states once made heavy investments in young families and training and jobs. We now make cash payments to the elderly for the most part, since aging electorates now want the prizes of pooling still ahead of them or within their immediate grasp. Welfare states used to invest in public infrastructure. We now save little, as Tony's mentioned, and in the process we build debt to lie on successors. Welfare states once spent little and satisfaction was relatively high. We now spend much and insecurity and dissatisfaction have risen proportionately. Welfare states once offered their young the promise of a better future and now offer them a declining quality of life. Need this happen? Studies of physical commons, such as I'm referring to here, Physical commons involving the sharing of land, for example, indicate that they're difficult but not impossible to manage if some sensible, simple essentials are observed. But they're very hard to pull back from the brink once the slide towards open access is underway. We have no precedents for a welfare state in an advanced stage of this psychological unravelling, and the outcome from here on is very uncertain. One option might be to do nothing, let things run on and see what emerges from the collapse. I fear in my darker moments that could involve considerable social disorder. The recent experiences of East Europe and the former Soviet Union are not encouraging on the advanced stages of a massive pooling operation gone south. Another option might be to say privatise the lot, to say that the experiment of an extensive common has failed, and that private property rights offer the only sustainable way of managing exchanges between individuals. There certainly may be room for expanding, there is room for expanding the sphere of private property as opposed to commons or open access transactions. Even so, though, that's unlikely to replace pooling in some form of welfare commons, which will remain necessary to assist the weakest, preserve social order, or to make the investments in infrastructure or education that are essential to the efficiency of private transactions. But if a welfare commons must remain, we'll have to relearn some lessons. And that, I think, we're doing already in the 1990s, if unconsciously. For basic commons issues underlie many of the political debates of the 1980s and increasingly of the 1990s. We need and are already reassessing the importance of firmer boundaries between private and commons rights. It's not proven wise to place too much under the laws and hence under the psychology of an ill-defined mass commons. We'll need to re-emphasise obligations to the commons as well as rights to it. Drawing on the pool will have to carry clear, specific and realistic duties. More contentious will be a necessary insistence upon transparency and upon policing of compliance. The recording and disclosure of individual actions towards the commons will sit uneasily with our individual liberal ethos, more especially as the computer makes surveillance a technical reality. Moving on, greater surveillance and policing is beginning, but thus far we're picking only the softest of targets, the welfare cheat who claims multiple benefits, or the father who doesn't pay maintenance. The greater problem is, and will prove to be, ourselves, ordinary decent citizens who are expecting and demanding far more in healthcare or pensions in old age, for example, than we've contributed in a lifetime of taxes. The way we seem likely to confront this is by grandparenting, as I understand in Australia, grandfathering. By grandparenting, the privileges and expectations of those now middle-aged and elderly, while progressively denying them to the later born, who must nevertheless pay for them. Well, that option is short-sighted, self-defeating, and without moral basis. It will hasten the corrosive suspicion undermining sound or sustainable pooling. It's simply not a decent option. Most troubling of all will be settling upon some new unit of pooling. I think that the thrust of the last century and more has been towards the nation state, and a welfare pooling on that scale. Global economics and technologies now raise the issue of a global commons in welfare as well as in land or sea or air. But pressures in the opposite direction will also be very strong. Western societies have for many centuries done a substantial amount of welfare pooling, much more than historians realised until recently, but we're beginning to reassess the amount, a very substantial amount of welfare pooling in the past. It was done both through public and private means. A fairly extensive welfare commons or welfare pooling seems to be fundamental to the nature of Western society. But before the 20th century, we always insisted upon pooling and redistributing at a very local level, where face-to-face decisions on give and take with the commons were paramount. And that may be, I think, the only practical option for a welfare state in the 21st century.
Thank you. Thank you, David. I neglected to say, for those who are interested, there's a few copies of David's book available out there. Now, we have, unfortunately, just a short question period, but I'm sure the first person would be pleased to take any questions or comments, so address them directly to whoever, but I'll direct that.
No, but I was most interested in at the very close of your address. What do you think of the Commonwealth distributing funds to states to distribute to local authorities so that the people in the streets say, hey, he shouldn't be getting old age pension, he's worth millions, or that kid shouldn't get the dole, I've offered him a job and he knocks it back. I mean, is that historically what happened in the European...
Historically, until the beginning of the 20th century, it was done in units, very small units, of populations of a few hundreds or at most a couple of thousand, with very little central direction. The clearest example is Britain and the Cordons, which was the sort of institutional framework for it. And that resulted in considerable local diversity, and some communities would settle upon fairly generous policies, some would be particularly needy, and we may have to tolerate quite a range of behaviours rather than impose one. It also produced changes over time, so it went through patterns, so the sort of expansion of welfare generosity and then the reacting against that, almost the model that we're seeing in the second half of the 20th century. Historians can see some of the cycles over a number of centuries. There seem to be quite standard patterns, almost over fairly standard time of a couple of decades of expansiveness. Let's try and assist a whole range of activities and sponsor a variety of behaviours and not try and make moral judgments and so on, followed by a few decades of retreat from that and the horror at the mounting costs and some of the moral behaviours that they find themselves supporting. So that's a historian, there's some striking parallels emerging in the sort of cycle of behaviours. But I think the model of the small commons, it wasn't something that past societies used or were stuck on because of sort of technological limitations. It wasn't simply that they couldn't enlarge their commons. There were good reasons for having small face-to-face communities deal with these issues. And it didn't simply mean that they would be very harsh or very generous. There would be a simple pattern to that. But I think they had learned that there are problems with mass commons. You do need to
Greg, can I just say briefly, I don't know how to, but the scale of the welfare fraud in WA last year, a strawberry grower was raided by the tax office, 60 refugee type migrants fled into the country, only three returned to work in the next week. In other words, the emphasis was 57 were on the dole. I asked four young staff in a hotel for their tax numbers, which someone had found the gift. Three left within 24 hours without giving notice. Three quarters were on the dole as well. That's the scale. In some.
David, the scale or the cycle of welfare benefits, I presume, fits pretty closely on the long-term economic cycle, a 40 or 50-year cycle.
Yes and no. It's not unrelated, but I'm not persuaded that it simply is the economic cycle. It almost seems as though the welfare cycles have an independent momentum of their own, perhaps lying in the sort of psychological states that I've suggested very briefly. In my more radical moments, I go the other way. The economic cycles have been driven. The flow of cause is not from economic to welfare, but that many of the problems of the late 20th century economy can be explained as sense rational products of the commons, on the levels of investment behaviour, as obvious examples. So it's not a simple reflection of the economic cycle, and it seems to have an independence somewhat of its own, almost in the psychological state that different ways of arranging transactions induce us.
Hmm. I might just ask one question, David, about the talk about going back to the smaller communities, and some would be more generous or less generous. I wonder whether the communities that were more generous attracted a greater number of potential recipients, which may have led to the desire to try and enlarge the commons, if you like, to try and stop that somehow. And of course, we get to this dilemma which just keeps on going.
Yeah. Well, that certainly does. Much of the history of welfare arrangements is about how you limit the group of the share the commons. In European societies, it was often known as the settlement laws. You had a legal right in one community and not in others. And much of the touring program is about is your legal entitlement to Perth or Geraldton, and the correspondence back and forwards, the shifting of money or the shifting of people, the house of people back and forwards to their place of legal entitlement. We wouldn't escape those issues, no, and that was the attraction of expanding the welfare state as it was to avoid those issues. It was one of those nice goals that we could learn from as far as experience and we don't get away from the issue.
Any questions?
Yeah, oh, for a number of questions. I'll just introduce myself, control myself. I'm just wondering, Dave, whether you were implying in your talk that the failure of the Western economic state was somehow due to the failure of the welfare state. Were you implying that?
Yes, I probably wasn't doing anything stronger than implying, because I don't know.
Because I want to follow that. I felt your discussion of the welfare state was quite ethnocentric and really focused on Anglo or English-speaking welfare states. And that when one looks at European countries until very recently, when even the global recession of Japan and North America has impacted now on Europe, and also the changes to Eastern Europe have had an effect. But until, say, 1990, one can look at countries such as Austria, Germany, Denmark, and Sweden, who all spend more on the welfare state than Australia, North America, or New Zealand, and some of them spend more than the UK, and all of which were able to sustain higher welfare spending and sustain higher levels of economic growth than both North America and Australia, and have lower rates of employment. Unemployment. I suppose what I'm saying is that I think when one looks at Western Europe, the causal relationship between declining economic conditions and the welfare state really comes into question. In other words, it's possible to have a highly developed welfare state and also have to have a good economy.
Well, I wouldn't agree with you that the European welfare states have avoided this dilemma.
I'm not saying they have avoided, I'm just saying they've been able to sustain economic growth.
Sustaining over a slightly longer period is not really sustaining if it collapses a little later. When I talk about these issues and the experiences of Australia and New Zealand in continental European countries, I find scholars responding very much that they see the same patterns. One of the things that European countries did rather disguised the process was, of course, to have very low birth rates and very, very, very low fertility rates has meant that they have avoided some of the distributional issues. They've been able to shift resources away from the young without it causing some of the tensions that it's producing in, for example, the Anglo-Saxon countries. But that, again, is not a sustainable. It's a way of shifting the time, pushing the business. I use the model of a badly managed company going bankrupt. There are various strategies you can do to delay the reckoning. And my reading is that the continental European countries have used certain strategies to delay the reckoning rather than change the liberal position. And one of the strategies that he used was unconsciously very low fertility, but that carries very high longer-term consequences for them. So in some ways, you might argue that they've dug themselves into deeper pits, but that those have not yet, for the day of reckoning, is only starting to arrive. Your general view, it also reflects a view that I've met in European discussions, considerable unwillingness or a great confidence in the welfare state that isn't always supported by the evidence on the levels of debt or underinvestment, but that there is a considerable national investment in a way that there isn't in the Anglo-Saxon countries in fostering the image of the success of the welfare state. So it's a considerable difficulty in talking about it. But I've found when the issues are opened up, more parallels than differences.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I think I'm going to have to call the formal part of this evening's proceeding calling for an end. I don't like to do it, and I'm sure we can carry on discussions informally, but we did advertise the seminar concluding at 7, and we're going to get past that now. But by all means, please stay on afterwards. I think we've heard a very extraordinary range of important issues put forward tonight. I think that the sort of work that these three gentlemen have been doing is going to be heard more and more. Certainly, some of the issues that Tony Rutherford raised will also become a critical part of the discussions in the near future. And I would like to invite all of you to join with me to thank them for their excellent expositions, and please then join us afterwards, of course.